So, hi everyone, and welcome to the second quantum gravity seminar of this week. Our speaker is Sabine Haribe, and she's currently a PhD student. She's doing a joint PhD at Ecole Polytechnique and Heidelberg University. And she will talk about the Mellonic large N limit of five index irreducible random tensors. As usual, if you want to ask questions, just raise your hand on Zoom, or if you want to ask an anonymous question, you can just use the anonymous Google form in the chat. And with this, Sabine, you can start whenever you want.
Thank you. So, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for inviting me to talk here today. So I'm going to present you one of my last papers with Sylvain Carosa about Mellonic large N limits of five index irreducible random tensors. So before speaking about this particular paper, I will introduce you random tensors and why we are interested in them. So first, let me give you a bit of history of a random tensor. They were first introduced in zero dimension in the context of random geometry and quantum gravity. So when I say zero dimension, is that it is just a combinatorial object. It is not a field. And they were introduced in an attempt to generalize matrix models in dimension higher than two and study quantum gravity in dimension higher than two. Indeed, they provided one possible definition of a discretized Euclidean quantum gravity. And in particular, for example, in rank three, they could be used to build random geometries by gluing tetrahedrons. However, this was limited because no large N limit was known for those generic tensor models. And also, there were very degenerate ways of gluing the tetrahedron. However, this was revised around 20 years later when a large N expansion was found for some specific kind of random tensors.
There is already a question by Lee.
This is all combinatorial, so you don't really mean tetrahedra. That is the dual, this is not a triangulation of a manifold.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand the question. So
when you say it's a gluing of a tetrahedra, is
yes.
It just a combinatorial description of a gluing of an object identified in terms of points and just joining them and so forth, or does it imply an embedding in a three-dimensional Euclidean space?
No, it's really a gluing of tetrahedrons themselves by associated different faces of the tetrahedron and gluing faces together of different tetrahedrons.
So if I have two tetrahedra, and can I turn the face in which I glue them?
Face.
In other words, if I have three edges here from one tetrahedra, and three edges here from another tetrahedra, how many ways are there to glue those three edges to the three edges?
Okay, so for those first model, I am not sure. I think the problem was that for those model, there were a lot of way to glue them because there were like no specific rule or not canonical way. And that's why those model were a bit stuck, and why then other kind of model that I was just mentioned afterwards were more interesting because they had some more ingredients that we called colors, and that implied only one way to glue two tetrahedron together for those okay. other models.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so yeah, so as I said, this was the main problem with this model, but then a large N expansion was found for a specific kind of model that I will describe just after. But this large N expansion was what we called a Mellonic large N expansion because the leading order graphs are melons. So we call them melons because they kind of look like the lines of a melon. So it's a graph with two vertices. So here is for rank three tensors connected by four edges. And then you construct them recursively by inserting this prime melon onto the edges. So one, two, or a big number. And so this limit was first found for what we call colored tensor models with, so in rank three, you have four different tensor fields. So you assign a color to each tensor. So you don't have just one tensor field, you have four of them. And this is, then this Mellonic limit was also found for other models later for uncolored, where we removed this color of the field, but we still had three indices that transform independently under different groups. But then this Mellonic limit was found to be much more generic for also other model that's with tensor. For example, in the SYK model, which is quantum mechanical model, we also find some kind of interactions that generate melons in the large N. So here the fields are fermions and the tensor is not the field, but this random coupling. And there are also a vast zoo of different models like multimatrix or models in higher rank. But for random geometry and quantum gravity, the models that were studied were the first one here, this colored tensor model. Why? Because they allowed color triangulation. And as Li's question pointed out, thanks to this color triangulation, we could glue a tetrahedron in a canonical way by having corresponding colors. But there were still some limitations because it was shown that these melons actually correspond to branched polymers, which are not the best for quantum gravity. So this is still an open challenge, and we need more ingredients to get out of this branched polymer phase. However, random tensors will continue to be studied because they can be used in a completely other setting, which is large N field theory. So why are we interested in large N field theory? So let me go back to more general motivations in terms of renormalization. So the idea behind renormalization group is that physics change with the energy scale. So we have a flow in the space of theories with respect to this energy scale, and we go to a fundamental theory in the UV to an effective one in the infrared. And then we will be interested in the theories that do not depend on the energy scale. So we want to look for fixed points and trajectories between those fixed points.
Sabine, sorry, there is another question by Hank.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, because you mentioned color triangulations and that there are gluing rules that correspond to these colors, right? So I'm just wondering how relevant is like the undecidability of Wang tiles, right? How do you know these triangulations actually tile 3D space? You know, Wang tiles is a 2D thing, but...
Can you repeat the last part of the question? I'm not sure I understood what you said.
Right. So given just the ingredients of the triangulation, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have a bunch of polyhedra, not necessarily tetrahedra, for example, and you assign color to the faces and the edges, etc. And then you try to glue them according to some gluing rules, right? But in 2D, let's say, we have a tessellation of the plane, and there's a result that says that, so these are called wing tiles in 2D. Even in 2D, it's not decidable whether these wing tiles tile the plane following these gluing rules, right? So I'm just wondering, like, how relevant is that going to be?
Okay. So I'm not really familiar with this, but for this triangulation, the thing is, with this triangulation, you can build 3D manifolds, but you are stuck with, you end up with something similar to branch polymers, so with a Hausdorff dimension of 2, so you're stuck at this point, and so this is still actually an open question, and it's still undecided how well you can describe actually a quantum gravity with this kind of triangulation.
Mm-hmm. It's just that, like, in 2D, wing tiles has been used to construct like a 2D lattice Hamiltonian whose spectral problem is undecidable. So, like, I'm just wondering, like, maybe the spectral problem would also be undecidable in this case.
Okay, I'm not completely familiar with this, but it's seems like a really interesting point.
Okay, thank you.
So that was the part on the motivation of studying random tensors for random geometry, but there is another motivation coming from a quantum field series. As I just said before, when studying quantum field theory, we study renormalization group and a fixed point of the renormalization group. But this is most easily done when you have a weak coupling and you can use a perturbation theory. Then if you want non-perturbative results or to study your theory with a strong coupling, the problem gets harder, and it's harder to have some non-perturbative results or results with strong coupling. But this is still really interesting if we can access those regimes, because then we could study some non-trivial fixed points or gain some control over non-perturbative phenomena that we could not be able to see if we stuck with only perturbation theories, such as spontaneous symmetry breaking or dynamical mass generation, for example. So that's where this Largen enters, because if we have another parameter, a large n, we can have an expansion in 1 over n while keeping a coupling that is not necessarily weak and non-perturbatively in the coupling. So this will give us a helpful approximation scheme to access some non-perturbative phenomena. And this has a vast area of application in, for example, statistical mechanics or QCD or even quantum gravity. So then why especially a tensor for this large n limits? So this kind of theory were actually first studied with vectors that admit a large n limit. So the field now is not just a scalar, but a vector field. And the large n expansion is dominated by this kind of cactus diagrams. So they are quite easy to study and to resum, but this is not very rich, because we only have here local insertion. Then we can go to matrices. Now the large n limit will be dominated by a planar diagram, so it's much more richer. But if you want to go and to study proper field theory, not in zero dimension, but in higher dimension, then it is very hard to resum. And then you can think, well, tensors, I'm adding more indices, it would be more complicated, but it's not, it's in between, because mainly of these melonic limits. So now the large n limit is dominated by those melons. So it's easier than the matrices because the Mellon diagrams are a subset of the planar ones here, but it's still richer than the vector one because we have now bilocal insertions, so we can have more phenomenon to study. So that's why that's what motivated the study of large M field theory with tensors. And so actually this was first done in dimension one in the context of strongly coupled QFTs and holography. Sorry, because if you remember earlier, I told you that this quantum mechanical model, the SYK model, that does not have a tensor, it's just a model of strongly interacting Majorana fermion, actually does have a Mellonic large N limit. So the idea was to generalize this, but with tensors, without the disorder that was needed in the original condensed matter model. So then this motivated studies of tensor field theories. So now we are looking at quantum field theory with a field which is a tensor. And actually this kind of model gave rise to a new class of conformal field theories. But again, as a quantum field theory, we have problem of divergences and we need to study the renormalization group, beta function, look for fixed points and look at the properties of the theory we obtain at the fixed point. And again, thanks to the Mellonic limits, this was actually doable. So let me just tell you a few of the main features of this Mellonic CFTs, Mellonic conformal field theory. So first, thanks to the Mellonic dominance, we have closed Schringer-Dyson equation. This is really characteristic of tensor models, and we can then compute explicitly the two-point function. We also have simplification of the four-point kernel that allows to compute a beta function and fixed point non-perturbatively in the coupling constant, but at large n. And then we obtain two different kinds of fixed points. In the usual model, so what I call short range here, it's the usual Laplacian of aquatic field theory. We can obtain some fixed points, but they are unstable and lead to a complex fixed point. But then we showed, so I won't go into the details here, for some kind of other model where we introduce a non-trivial power of the Laplacian, we obtain exact marginality and lines of fixed points, stable fixed points. And then this Mellonic CFT recently, in the past couple years, were studied a bit in more details. And it was shown that at the fixed point, the CFT we obtain as bilinear operators of real dimension above unitarity bounds and real OP coefficients. So we have something that is unitary at large n. Okay, so we have two different motivation to study a random tensor. So to summarize, first in zero dimension, in order to do to study random geometry and quantum gravity. So this is with colored model. Then in higher dimension, if we want to do proper field theory, we can use these uncolored tensor models and study a new kind of conformal field theory. But this is only two very specific type of tensor models. But what about other representation, other symmetries? As I told in the beginning, when tensor models were first studied, they were considered as complete symmetric tensors, and we didn't have a Mellonic large N limit. However, recently it was conjectured that if instead of taking something completely symmetric, we consider an irreducible representation, so symmetric traceless or anti-symmetric, for example, we could obtain a Mellonic large N limit. And this was then proven in rank 3, first for ON symmetry, then SPN with fermions. And so the paper I want to present to you today was the generalization of this in higher rank. Because here it's only proven for rank 3, whereas for these other tensor models, we know it for arbitrary rank. So here we went one step further with rank 5.
So before you continue, there is a question by you.
Yes. Can you, are these models for which you can write down a corresponding Lagrangian or an action principle?
For which one of the theories? For the Melonic CFT?
Whichever one you want. So I just want
Yes, for the Melonic CFT, we have an action.
Okay. What does it look like?
So it's just the usual action you have in a 5-4 model.
Okay.
Like you take the usual 5-4 model from basic renormalization group in QFT, but mm-hmm. your field phi, instead of being a scalar, now is a tensor. So in here, most of the study were done in rank 3, so you have 3 indices. And then you just have this usual action with the free term, which is just phi square, and then a phi 4. But the difference with the tensor is that you can have other invariants in the action. So yeah, I did not write it here because I will then go on with zero dimension. But so the action, instead of having one phi 4 interaction, you have in rank 3, 3 different, because then now you have tensors, you have multiple invariants, but you can write this action and then derive Schwinger Dyson equation, beta function, etc. from it.
But there's no derivative. This is like the matrix model, a quench limit of a quantum field theory, which is a matrix model.
Yes, yes. This is just general.
Right. So then what is D when you make an expansion in 4 minus epsilon?
Oh, yeah. So here D is the dimension of the space-time. It's the space-time dimension. So the field is a tensor, so rank 3, for example, or you can go rank five, etc.
In a four-dimensional
and
space.
D is your dimension of your space-time.
So there is an embedding in the space-time.
Oh, yes, yes. When you do a Melonic CFT, there is embedding in the space-time. Yeah, it's like it's a proper quantum field theory.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so if there are not no other question on the introduction, I will now present you the results in questions. So first I will present the model we studied, the perturbative expansion, and I will sketch a little bit the proof, which was very technical, so just a sketch. So the model we studied was here, it's not field theory anymore, it's just a combinatorial model. So we have tensors of rank 5. And first, we have here a covariance that is now a projector on irreducible representation. So for example, symmetric traceless or anti-symmetric or some mixed symmetry. And then we have a sextic interaction, which is, so this complicated expression can be understood easily with a drawing. So it's a 5 simplex interaction. So meaning that I have 6 tensors and I have a complete graph here. Each tensor share exactly 1 index with every other tensor. So I highlighted some color here. For example, this tensor, the first index is with here the last tensor. So this is this red edge. So I represented here each tensor with 5 strands, represented all of the 5 indices, and then I connect the strands whenever 2 indices are contracted between the tensors. So this is why we call this interaction a 5 simplex interaction, and it is just a generalization of the usual tetrahedron interaction you can see in range 3 tensor models. But here, the key point is that instead of having just a simple covariance, we have a projector on irreducible representation, and that would be the key point of our study. Then once we have that, we can do a perturbative expansion into a Feynman graph. So explicitly, we look at this F because it expands onto connected combinatorial maps. So for example, that would be the kind of maps we have for the vacuum and just one vertex. But the thing is, this is not so nice if we want to look at the scaling in N, which is what we are interested in, since we want to prove that this admits a large N expansion. So why is that? It's because here, all these edges, they can actually be represented with 5 strands, just as I did in the previous slide here. Each of the vertex here is actually this whole big interaction vertex, and then the half edges here have 5 strands. So actually, in this maps, there for each half edge, 2 half edges, I have a total of 945 ways to connect them between themselves. So this is not only one graph, this is a lot of stranded graphs if I replace all the edges by these strands. And actually, the fact that we have a projector on irreducible representation will give to all these different terms different weights and signs, and that will be the main key in the proof of the large N expansion later. So in order to look at the large N expansion and to see if we indeed have a well-behaved large N expansion, we will not look at these combinatorial maps, but more precisely at the stranded maps. So it is a combinatorial map like this when we chose only one term in our projector. So for example, for a symmetric traceless projector, I do have the 945 terms in the projector. But for an anti-symmetric one, for example, I have only factorial 5 choice for each propagator. So we will look at these standing maps and try to see if we can determine their scaling in N. So the first step for this is to see that in all those ways to connect the half edges, we can actually group them into different types, and just 3 types of edges. So first we will have what we call unbroken edges where all the strands traverse. So that means if we have a tensor at each end, we contract the indices between the 2 tensors. Then we have broken edges. In this case, a pair is connected by a strand at each end. So if I have a 2 tensor here, it means that in one tensor, I have 2 indices of the same tensor that are contracted. So it's more like a trace term. And we can show that all those terms will have a weight of 1 over n. And then we have a doubly broken one. So it's the same, but now I have 2 pairs on each end. So this means that I will have a tensor with 2 pairs of indices in the same tensor contracted. So more like kind of a double trace term. And this would be rescaled by 1 over n squared. So once we notice that, we can look at how those my maps scale in N. And without going into too much details, we can show that the amplitude of the maps will have this form. So this K here, it's just a number that will depend on the specific representation I choose. So we can compute it explicitly for symmetric traceless or anti-symmetric, but the key point is that it's independent of N. And then I have the scaling in N with minus omega, and omega will be what we call the degree. And this degree, we can compute it with what I noticed in this previous slide, and noticing that in my stranded maps, every time I have a face, meaning a closed cycle, because this corresponds to a contraction of indices in tensor, this will amount to one free sum, and so one factor of n. So then this degree has this form. So the first 2 terms here come from my convention here. I have a convention of 1/5 here. And for each vertex, I have also the lambda that is weighted by 1/5. And then, as I told you, that I will have a factor of n for each broken edge and n square for each double broken, and then minus a factor of 1/n for each face. So this is the degree. And knowing that the amplitude looks like this, now to prove that we have a 1/n expansion, it is enough to prove that this degree omega is non-negative. So this is the goal, to prove that omega is non-negative, first step. And then if we want this 1/n expansion to be melonic, we want to prove that when omega is zero, the maps are melonic. So before doing some complicated combinatorics on this stranded map, we can wonder if there are some maps that are trivially of positive degree. And when you look at this expression, naively, if we don't have too many faces, this will be positive because all the other terms are positive. So naively, you can say that if you have only very long faces, meaning faces that take a high number of edges in your graph, you then cannot have too many faces in your graph, and this will be positive. And so this is just the naive idea, but doing that more precisely with some combinatorics on by considering the number of faces of a specific length, we can actually rewrite the degree like this. And then you explicitly see here that indeed, if you have faces of always only faces of lengths greater than 3, this is always positive. So we don't need to look at all the graphs. We only need to look at the graphs that are faces of lengths 1 or 2, which we call short faces. And so what are the faces? It's faces that will appear in tadpoles, so when you have one self-loop, or double tadpoles, and especially also faces in melons and dipoles. So we restricted our problem to only a subcategory of maps to where we have to bound the degree. Okay, so now the naive thing we would like to show is that, oh, for all those graphs, actually the degree is also positive. But the problem, the tricky part, is that this is not true. For example, we can look at a specific kind of double tadpole. So double tadpole is a two-point function with one vertex and two safe loop. And so remember that here, each edge is actually 5 strands that can be connected in a high number of different ways. And there is a way to connect them so that the internal faces will look like this. So this is a simplified drawing to render how the internal faces behave. So we will have 4 internal faces, 2 of length 1 and 2 of length 2. And then here the external strands, sorry, on the two external points will behave like a doubly broken edge. So if I look only at this one map, it's not a problem because I have a factor n4 from the faces and a 1/n5 for the vertex, so it scales like 1/n, I still have a positive degree. However, if I start to glue those tadpoles together to form a chain, every time I will add one double tadpole here, because of this propagator, this doubly broken propagator, I will close 2 faces. So actually, with a chain of a p of those double tadpoles, I will have a scaling like n to the p minus 1, which is unbounded from above, and I can generate arbitrarily negative degree. So at this point, you can be a bit sad, your expansion doesn't work, but actually, this is only for one stranded configuration. And remember that we have a projector on irreducible representation, and it has different weight on all the terms of the projector. So actually what we can show is that if we bound the whole map here, the one that is on the left, we will have non-trivial constellation. And actually, those bad double tadpoles that generate a negative degree don't contribute to the final expansion. So I won't go into the detail of the proof, but we actually managed to do that and to say that even if the stranded mass have a negative degree, because we have an irreducible representation, we can bound the amplitude of the full combinatorial maps, and then the double tadpoles as combinatorial maps, not just as stranded one, or well behave. And we can also show like this that the melons contribute to leading order. So this means that if we want to look at the degrees of stranded maps, we will have to subtract those configuration, those double tadpoles. But not only the double tadpoles, because as the melons contribute to a leading order, if I insert them here on the edges of my double tadpole, I will have a map without double tadpole, but still the same degree. So I can generate some generalized double tadpoles we will have arbitrarily negative degree. So actually, to be able to study the stranded maps, we need to subtract both the melons and the double tadpoles. Okay, so now that we've done this first analysis of our model and what will be the problematic cases, I can just give you the main theorem of the paper is that we do have this large N expansion. Our free energy here can be written as a sum, as an expansion in 1 over N with a positive degree. And there are three main steps to this proof. First, as I just explained, we need to subtract the double tadpoles and the melons that can be problematic at the level of stranded maps. Then we will restrict to unbroken edges. And finally, we will be able, with an induction, to bound the degree of the remaining graphs. So I will just now sketch the tools we use for each one of these steps. So for the first step, subtracting the melons and the double tadpoles, we considered a theory with a modified covariance and a subtractive interaction. And we managed to show that we could choose this K here in the modified covariance to such that this was our original theory. And this was done thanks to a partial resummation of the perturbative theory that was governed by a closed algebraic Schwinger-Dyson equation. So now we have a new perturbative expansion just in terms of the graphs with no tadpoles and no melons. Then the second step was to restrict to only one kind of edges, the unbroken ones. So this is done by noticing that we can do some operation on our edges called cut and glue. So this means that here, if I have two strands, I will cut two pair of strands, I cut them, and then I re-glue them in a different way. So here they were looping back on the same side of the propagator, and then they traverse. And if you look a little bit in more detail to the combinatorics of this move, you can see that it can do only three things: add a face, remove a face, or leave the number of faces unchanged. So that means that if I remove here a broken edge, I will decrease the number of faces by at most one, but I will also decrease the number of broken edges by one. And because they contributed with a factor n to the degree, that means that when I do this operation, the degree can only decrease. And it's the same for the doubly broken one. So that means that I can restrict myself to graph with only unbroken edges. And if I show that they have positive degree, the other graph with doubly broken and broken one will also have positive degree. And then we come to the last step of the proof. That was that once the remaining graphs have positive degree. So namely that if a stranded graph has no double tadpole, no melon, and no unbroken edges, the degree is positive. And then this proof was done by induction, but I won't go into the details here because this was the most technical proof of the paper. Because in order to prove that, we had to, at each step of the induction, to look for a strict subgraph that we could delete of our graph without increasing the degree and preserving the constraints. And to do that, we needed to perform an exhaustive graph theoretic distinction of cases, and we had to deal with a very high number of particular two-point subgraphs. So this was really involved, but the conclusion is that at the end of the day, we could bound the degree of those graphs, and so a proof of theorem that this model with irreducible representation of the tensor and the five simplex interaction indeed has large n limits. And so the last step is to show that this large n limit is dominated by melons. And again, naively, we can think that all the stranded graphs with no melon will be subleading. But again, this is not true. And at the level of the stranded graph, we can have graphs with no melon and a vanishing degree. And it's the same principle as we had before with the bad double tadpoles. At the level of the stranded graph, we can have this problematic configuration, but if we bound the full combinatorial map, we have non-trivial cancellation between the different terms in our projector. So that's what we did. We studied bounds on the full combinatorial maps and show that actually the maps with no melons are subleading. And so we could conclude that a Feynman map was of leading order if and only if it was melonic. So to conclude, we studied an irreducible tensor model with five simplex interaction, and we managed to show that this model admitted a large N expansion dominated by melon diagrams. This was done through recursive bounds derived from a detailed combinatorial analysis of the Feynman graphs. And along the way of our proof, we also estimated the scaling of a number of 4 and 8 point functions. So actually, it would not be such a big step to also include other effective interaction in our action at the beginning. And this would be interesting if we want to apply those kind of model to a large N quantum field theory, because in this case, we will need to include all the interactions that can be generated through the renormalization group. It would be also interesting to see if we can also prove the melonic large N expansion for model with Fermionic field and SPN symmetry, because this was done in rank 3. So this should still hold for rank 5. And then the big question would be, how can we generalize this to arbitrary rank? Because for colored and uncolored models, we have the large N expansion for all rank. But here we see that the proof relies heavily on the rank we are looking at. And going from rank 3 to rank 5, we saw the number of particular cases and distinction we have to make grow quite drastically. So we could imagine that if we want to go to higher degree, this would be too difficult. So in order to generalize this to a larger degree, we will need to find other new tools. And so that would be an interesting direction for further study. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks for Sabine for this very nice talk. Okay, are there questions? First from students. So at the moment, I do not see questions from students. So the first question is by Bianca then.
Thanks, Sabine, for this interesting talk. I have two questions. One, is there some application for these rank 5 tensor field theory? And what about rank 4?
Okay, so for application in rank 5, so it would be to look at a sextic quantum field series. So we looked at already at some sextic tensor field theory, but with rank 3 tensor or usually a rank 5 with a ON to the 5 symmetry. And so it's interesting to look at sextic quantum field theory, but the problem was that in rank 5, we found only trivial fixed points. So the application could be to try to look at this quantum field theory with rank 5 and but irreducible representation, and maybe this could lead us to have a non-trivial fixed point.
Mm-hmm. So
and then
no,
for the...
But for, there's no quantum gravity interpretation if we have these irreducible representations? In terms of gluing rules or something?
Not directly. Mm-hmm. I haven't studied this yet, but the hope would be that this would be really interesting to study, because as this is a new kind of tensor model, maybe this could be used to get out of this branch polymer phase. But okay. This is for the moment. This is not. This is very far. We just study this model like this. And for your second question about rank 4, yes, we can study rank 4. So here we focus on rank 5 for two reasons. Because if we want to apply to QFT, it's more usual to look at sextic model with six fields in the interaction that wins five fields. And the second reason was just for simplicity. Because if I go back... here, when I said that we needed to look only at faces of lengths 1 and 2, actually in rank 4, like in rank 3, we also need to look at faces of length 3. So you have more cases to look at, and the fact to be in rank 5 restricts you to those two problematic cases. So that was also one of the reasons we chose to look at rank 5 and not rank 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but rank 4 would lead to 4 dimensions.
So rank 4 could be more interesting in the context of random geometry, mm-hmm. and rank 5 more in the context of QFT.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Are there other questions? So let me ask a couple of questions. So first, a basic one. I actually did not get why what you call degree omega cannot be negative. First, maybe start with this. Omega of G. You have shown this equation at some point. Yes.
Yeah, so here that's the theorem. So at first, we don't know that it is positive, and it's mm-hmm. those three step here that leads to proving that it is positive.
Mm. Okay.
So as I said, like here we actually have some configuration in which case it is negative, some stranding configuration, but when bonding the full graph with all the terms from the projector on the irreducible representation, these cases when it is negative cancel. And then the full map is well behaved. But this is a really non-trivial. So the first step here, or maybe not that complicated, subtracting these maps and restricting to unbroken edges, but actually this last step, this induction, when we look in detail at some specific graph, it required really a long induction and really an exhaustive distinction of cases in order to bound the degree of each graphs.
Mm-hmm.
So just that here, I didn't went into the details because it's very long. We have a lot of cases, and some after that we have some particular two-point function to look at. So that's the main difficulty here, to indeed prove that it is positive, because at the beginning this is not given.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. Thanks. Another question would be whether you can first of all, generalize this proof to higher dimensions. Also, if there is any alternative proof that you can use, because this proof by induction might be difficult to generalize when you go to higher rank cases.
Yes, yes, that's exactly the problem for the moment. The proof we have both for rank 3 and rank 5, they rely heavily on the specific rank we are looking at with this distinction of cases and induction. So that's really for the next step, the next work to do would be to go back to this proof and try to see some common features and maybe to use stronger combinatorial bounds that can be derived for arbitrary rank in order to go higher. Because at this point, if we keep with this kind of proof, going to rank 6 or 7 might not be possible with this method yet, because it is really involved already in rank 5. So if we go higher, maybe we will have only faces of length 1 to look at some point, not even faces of length 2. But then the distinction of cases and the particular cases really grow. So that's not done yet. It's still open, and it is for future work to find an alternative proof.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Thanks. More questions? Okay, so if not, then let's thank again Sabine for her nice talk and very nice discussion.
Thank you.